Okay, so I'm Julian Bleeker. I'm going to talk to you about how science fiction film helps think about and create discussions of the future. And I'm not going to try to provide a definition as to what design fiction is, but I will say, just to sort of paint some of the contours of it, it's less about planning, it's less about forecasting, it's not really about prognostication or necessarily the kinds of traditional ways in which people plan the future in, you know, so maybe in corporate context and that sort of thing. The way I like to think about it, and I think all of us here share this kind of insight, it's more like using stories to provoke the imagination, creating speculation, creative speculation, suspending disbelief. It's an approach to design by using material to think with, and it's a way of starting and circulating conversations. And for me, being a sort of engineer and very tactile kind of guy, I'm very interested in the way in which you can use prototyping, use design fiction as a kind of prototyping to help think through and work through new ideas. So really getting into the material, prototyping experiences, prototyping objects that might not be 100% functional, or they might represent technologies that aren't entirely possible, but they give you a sort of prop with which you can start having conversations about what that thing might do and what the world might look like with it in it. So this is the connection there between design and fiction is obviously design plus perhaps science fiction. And so again, rather than a definition, I might pose this question that I use myself when I start thinking about this topic. How can we design the future the way it's thought about, the way it's described, the way in which people argue over it, discuss it, imagine it, by using some of the rich genre conventions of science fiction film. Now, I'm picking film in particular. Of course, there are other genres of science fiction. There are other sort of vernaculars. There are other idioms in which science fiction operates. I'm focusing on film, partially because I'm a film nerd and because I'm a science fiction film nerd. And I see these examples of the way in which the film, moments in various films are ways of essentially speculating about a certain kind of future. And there are also these sort of almost like production or technical conventions or attributes of science fiction film that I find exceptionally useful when I'm trying to help describe to someone a particular near future world that I might be imagining. So staying on schedule, I'm gonna offer four examples that that I think are very powerful ways in which science fiction film as a medium, has been used to variously design, imagine, engineer, speculate about, provoke conversations about some aspect of the future. And these four are sort of standouts in my mind. There are dozens and dozens of others that I would love to share with you and that are living on my hard drive someplace. But in the interest of kind of moving things along, just providing this kind of contour of what design fiction might be, I'll stick to these. So Destination Moon, a film that was produced in 1950, right during the Red Scare, is a USA-produced film where essentially trying to promote the idea that we should go to the moon. It's sort of ideological kind of and technical aspects of that challenge that are worked through in the film. 2001, A Space Odyssey, 1968, Jurassic Park in 1993, and Minority Report from 2001. Okay, so this is Destination Moon. 1950, the sci-fi writer Robert Heinlein was both the one of the writers, but he was also a technical consultant, so he had a background in engineering when he was in the U.S. Navy. So he had kind of this dual role in it. He was actually working on the writing of the film, but also working through some of the technical challenges of going to the moon. And the producer of the film, George Powell, described it as a documentary of the near future. So this to me was a very powerful kind of like signpost that describes the film as something that is more than just a kind of middling science fiction drama about going to the moon. It was much more about, you know, showing all the parts of, you know, what it would take to actually go there. Remember, this is before people really figured out how you would get to the moon. It wasn't a routine kind of thing by any means. So they had to deal with stuff like, you know, what might the environment suits like. They had to kind of basically prototype some of the experiences like doing an EVA, or how the heck do you get out of the thing once it's kind of landed on the moon. So they have this kind of ladder mechanism where they shimmy down the side of it, dangle off of it, and then the other guy helps the other guy kind of work his way down. So, you know, in retrospect, of course, there's a sort of comic element to this, as there should be for like a 1950s science fiction film. But what's really going on behind the scenes in the production is that they're taking it quite seriously. So they're trying to really work through what would be the engineering challenges of actually doing this. And there are a number of ways in which they do that throughout the course of the film that I think, and the production of the film that I think make it quite relevant. 2001: A Space Odyssey. Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and various rocket scientists, quite literally, working on this film contemporary with the Apollo space program. So at this time, of course, there's the space races in full swing. The film came out in 1968. You know, right when people are you know, planning these, planning on going to the moon. So the question of what would space flight really look like is high in the minds of people at this point in time. And Kubrick is sort of working through a number of the challenges that might befall this kind of mission, including things like this, just sort of looking at like what the technical displays of spacecraft might look like. And Kubrick, being Kubrick, wants to get it right and wants it to look as people might see in the coming years when space flight actually takes place. Jurassic Park, Spielberg, Crichton, and Jack Horner, who's a paleontologist. The film makes the unbelievable believable through this kind of extrapolation of bioscience. So bioscience kind of really sees itself flourished when it's expressed in this film as these dinosaurs are brought to life. And of course, it also brings it sort of incites these riots within the paleontology community over the facts of dinosaurs' behavior. So there's a very interesting way in which the film has this ideological dimension where it's describing how dinosaurs actually look. Minority Report is this film that circulates within the sort of popular imaginary what gesture interfaces might be, and it becomes like a reference point for people nowadays, of course, when they say, like, what do you mean gesture interface? Okay. People will say, well, it's like that thing in Minority Report. So what? Design fiction. So what do we do with this? There's this idea of the diegetic prototype that's worked through this material. So cinematic depictions of future technologies are actually diegetic prototypes. This is something that this scholar David Kirby described. Effectively, they become ways of working through ideas, of prototyping ideas in a very material way through a film and through its story. And so why would we be interested in this? Well, the plain sort of simple way of saying is that you can do things in science fiction and you can do things with storytelling that you can't do with traditional techniques. So if you don't allow yourself to imagine and speculate and push beyond the bounds of what is literally possible, then you're really limiting yourself in terms of how you think about what you create. And so now we'll pass it on to Sasha, who's going to give you some more examples from his work.
Where's mine? Here, okay, yeah. A bit. Okay. Hi. My name is Sasha Poflip, and I think, yeah, oops. Is it running automatically? No, for this crowd, like, this should be enough, I thought. I'm an artist, and I also design. Oops. And I'm, sort of based in London. And I titled this talk, We Might Be Living in the Wrong Experiment. That's actually a quote by Jeff Manow, who writes the amazing building blog at Exit Art in New York recently. So one could say that basically all technology is probably an experiment, and thus the subject of promises and realities that follow after. But especially if you look at the 1970s and 1960s, we were actually promised different things. So this is a NASA illustration from the 70s, the Space Colony by Rick Guidis, one of the two illustrators who worked for NASA. So it's basically the Bay Area in space, as you can see. but a few years later, the promise radically changed. So suddenly there was SDI and... I don't know if you can read it. It says multiple kill vehicles, artist rendering. So something had happened, basically. But what had happened? And basically, this had happened. So somebody with a much different agenda was in place and tweaked the goals. If you want, it's the second time cover today. So this is especially interesting because it really shows that our technological future, even though it quite didn't happen like this with SDI. Is always a matter of choice. And it's interesting to look at like how we usually talk about the future. So in this kind of scenario-making technique that was popularized during the Cold War, is usually that you look where you stand currently and you try to extrapolate a future from that point and kind of talk about that. But knowing, like as we just saw, that things could have been very different if Reagan would have yeah, I mean, you're going to see later, but like things, there's always these like neuralgic points in time where kind of things, decisions are being made, and it might actually be make sense to turn around and try to find these points and ask whether there were any real alternatives and why those alternatives weren't selected at the time, and even how could such alternatives be reclaimed now. And that's actually a quote by Langdon Winner from his book The Whale and Reactor, which I it's like 1980s book about technology, and highly recommended. So, and if you talk about energy technology, there was actually such a point in time, which was the 1980 US election, which put Reagan into power in 1981. And obviously Carter had a very different idea of these things, and then Reagan went and changed many things. So what this is proposing is basically to look at a counter, what some people call counterfactual history, what other people call alternate reality, starting at 1980, and what could have been considering Carter's focus on renewable energy and maybe exaggerating it as well to kind of make a point. And all this is basically to open up what I try to call a possibility space to talk about actually our own challenges as well. So in this world, Carter goes and takes something called National Renewable Energy Lab, which actually exists in Golden, Colorado, and they happen to, they basically lost 95% of their funding when Reagan came into place. And he takes it instead and elevates it into this kind of earthbound NASA with the same audacity and funding that was behind the Apollo missions. This kind of like just send us the receipts attitude, basically just like, you need to do this, then just do it. And it becomes the Golden Institute. So how's this being told? By creating a narrative and basically materializing things that you're just going to see in a second, such as a character named Douglas Arndt, who you see there, a painting and a few models which sat in the lobby of this fictitious institution. And while the scenario is basically somewhat exaggerated, the engineering parts of it are quite sound and have been conceived and designed with engineering people from the Imperial College in London. So Douglas Arndt, he's kind of the face of the Institute, and he's the prolific senior strategist who frequently appears on TV, and he kind of like talks about the Institute's projects that have a significant impact in American life, like later in the 80s. And this character is basically actually based on this guy who you can find at archive.org. It's an amazing US Army video about like how one rocket that he kind of helped with ended the Cold War, which is completely ridiculous, but it's an amazing video. So the Institute's projects, and that's really important, work on different levels and scales, and that's kind of an important point for the project because it tries to talk about how change could happen in a highly industrialized society. So there's, first, there's the scale of the planetary, pursuing geoengineering and taking charge of the planet as a system, trying to create artificial thunderstorms to harvest lightning. And that's being told through a painting, which is, it's quite dark, which is can actually run it again if you want, which is montage from different sources, and it shows Golden in the foreground in Colorado, well powered, and in the distance you see an artificial sun, thunderstorm, and like tall conductors that catch lightning and make it like make the electricity available to consumers, and these like little silver iodide filled balloons in the corner to seed the thunderstorms in the first place. Then there's the level of nation infrastructure, is kind of like the intermediate one. And that's using the American freeway system, which is basically metal objects with people in them, fast metal objects, as a source of power. And this is done through installing induction loops at freeway off-ramps operated by a cafe chain called Chuck's Cafe. And you see a model of it here. That's one of the lobby art things I was talking about. So the driver of the car doesn't actually brake when exiting the freeway, but instead they are being slowed down by the so-called Lorentz force when like a magnetic thing passes through induction coils. And you can maybe see that like the loop says Chuck says thanks, and that's because Chuck gets to keep some of the electricity, or like most of the electricity, and the driver gets a cup of coffee or a discount on a cup of coffee. And then finally there's the scale of the individual, which is people want to participate economically, and actually kind of like the Institute encourages it as well, because for them it kind of goes back to Benjamin Franklin and the kite. So what people do is that they hack their cars, and what you see here is And what you see here is a Chevy El Camino that's been modified to be a lightning harvester. And you see like the huge lightning rod on the pickup part of it. And in the back, there's an array of supercapacitors to temporarily store the electricity while you're on the way to one of the drive-through energy exchanges, which is a really, really dangerous ride. And so to conclude, these things are meant to be social objects that open up the possibility space and like a discourse around them. And interestingly, what I found last year, Jimmy kind of agrees as well.
So you see, the point I'm making is that technological advances are there, provided our nation's great scientific and engineering capability are marshaled and focused on those key opportunities.
Okay, thank you. Oh, yeah. Which one was this? This one? Yeah. Okay. But it needs to go. That's the. Is that the first one? This one. Okay. There you go.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jake Donegan from the Institute for the Future. I want to talk to you today about political systems design fictions. It's something I've been interested in, and it's. Involves work that I did with Stuart at the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies and in our work with Found Futures, a kind of futures art project, and then also the recent work at the Institute for the Future. So the premise is that, it didn't take Copenhagen or healthcare reform to make us see that our political systems are failing and they're broken. And there's a desperate need for us to imagine new kinds of political systems, not just mild reforms. Wiki government is great, but I think we need something much more profound if we're going to deal with global problems and local problems. I think our political systems aren't very good at many things these days. So we need to be able to design and prototype new political systems. And you don't see many of them. I mean, you have some crackpot sci-fi writers and artists and, goofy cultists and doing a few of them, and maybe an academic futurist or a political scientist or some octogenarian emeritus scholar on his deathbed who thinks he's got it all figured out. And you see almost none from people working in government. And you see almost literally none that are not just conceptual, but they're actually immersive, experiential, meaty, 3D experiences of different political futures. And that's what we're trying to do. So in Hawaii, at the Hawaii 2050 Sustainability Kickoff, Stuart and I and some colleagues developed four alternative futures for Hawaii. These are based, one is a continued growth scenario, one's a collapse or a post-collapse, one's a discipline scenario, and one is a transformation scenario. Now, amongst the other elements that we put into these, actors, props, soundscapes, to put the flesh and bones on these futures, each came with their own system of government. In fact, the system of government kind of drove the storyline and told the story of how governance itself adapted to these different worlds and these different futures. They exhibited, what we tried to exhibit was kind of the used future, or what Bruce not too long ago was talking about with William Gibson, the pre-distressed antique futurity. We tried to embody that in our work. So each scenario, each future that people experienced was an attempt for them to act as if that future actually existed, and that some kind of solutions were made by governments, either muddled through solutions or muddled through non-solutions to climate change, peak oil, peak everything, and high-tech transformations. So here's what we did. The first one was, this is a continued growth story. So we had our participants come in there, and they were told that this is a debate between two candidates for the governorship of Hawaii. Well, these two candidates happened to be corporations. So as legal persons, corporations were able to run for office. We thought this was kind of far-fetched, so we put it out in 2050. Recent Supreme Court decisions have pushed our timeline earlier. The future catches up to you, even if you try to be ridiculous. So we told the story of a continued growth Hawaii, overpopulation. One of the candidates is Aloha Nuclear and Water, so they solved two big issues, power and potable water. The other candidate was Kobayashi Virtual Concern, so their platform was they're going to create sort of an artificial intelligence based on all their virtual worlds and create a system of governance around that. The next one was a induction ceremony into the citizen soldier army of the Democratic Kingdom of Hawaii. So this is an induction ceremony for climate refugees off the boat from flooded islands in the Pacific. And immediately off the boat, you're inducted. You take an oath to the king, and you get a citizenship card. So that was the experience there. That's a kind of a post-collapse scenario. The next one was a mandatory training day. So this is a steady state, sustainable, Hawaiian values-based future where basically your life is sort of mandated by the dictates of sustainability. And so people came in sort of like jury duty, but they do it more often. You come in every weekend for training. So in this case, we had them trained on making biofuels and making products out of hemp. So you're sort of, it's a communal atmosphere and you're supposed to participate. And then finally, this is kind of a techno-utopia welfare state. So the participants came in as unaugmented humans, and they were bringing down the happiness quotient. And the hive mind government was offering them a free post-human upgrade, augmentation. And this presentation was a menu of choices they could pick to augment themselves. So the idea that in this method. Is that it's the experience first and the imagination second. So we don't have to say, can you imagine living in this future? Well, hell, you just did for 20 minutes in this case. And I think that's important. And we call this future shock therapy. So it's the idea that it's a psychosocial therapeutic art that's designed to be engaging, mobilizing, curious, confusing, exciting, subversive. And since there's no chief to put the pillow over our lobotomized future, we use future shock therapy to try to jolt us into seeing the future and experiencing it and being able to cognize possibilities in ways that we haven't before. So the 2050 was kind of an enclosed setting where we had 600 people move from room to room. We've done since then other projects where we did a project called Postcards from the Future, where we mailed out a postcard from a different version of Hawaii. We did a project for Honolulu's Chinatown where we kind of dressed the town, the area of Chinatown in as a sort of a movie set. We did one around a pandemic flu outbreak. This was a couple of years ago. So we put up signs. We had some sort of a wailing wall there. And then Maui decided to take advantage of Oahu's tragedy by poaching tourists. And that's the poster there in the bottom right. Okay, and then another method that's sort of emerging is alternate reality games. So this is, you know, trying to tap into the wisdom or lunacy of the crowd. And creating sort of ad hoc social formations and putting them to the test and within the real play, not role play model. It's a good way to experiment and prototype new political systems. And at the Institute, late in 2008, we did a project called Superstruct, which is kind of, since Bruce is in the room, it's kind of a project to build new social systems on the ruins of the unsustainable. So we had people developing, you know, thousands of players developing new ideas of how we're going to deal and solve the major threats that are pushing us toward collapse. And one of my favorites was one based on a political system based on quantum politics. So it's a non-Newtonian-based political system. So there's all kinds of really interesting projects that came out of that. And then we're going to launch a project on the future of California this fall or summer, and my goal is to have whatever sort of comes out of this ARG or game be a write-in candidate for governor. So maybe some hive mind ARG-related candidate will come out of that. So just to kind of sum up, we have grand challenges. We don't have the luxury of grand narratives, so we're going to have to piece this stuff together. It's going to be muddled, it's going to be experimental, and it might not work. But we do need a new generation of political systems designers, and I hope that will be some or all of you. Thanks.
All right. My name's Stuart Candy. I don't have any slides, but I'm futurist with a Y instead of an I on Twitter. And like Jake, I'm coming at this topic from the perspective of futures studies. I'm the first research fellow of the Long Now Foundation and a senior researcher at the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies. And the title for my contribution to this panel today is A Long View for Design Fiction. And it's a long view in the sense that, the two examples I'm going to run through both concern designing over a longer time period than some of the things that we've heard about so far, except with the possible exception of some of Jake's examples there. And it's also a long view in that I think what I want to do here is sort of zoom out a little bit from the more concrete examples that Julian's and Sasha and Jake have given, in visual and tangible and multimedia manifestations of possibilities, to look at design fiction more broadly and what's sort of around the edges of that concept, rather than sort of trying to define it in a rigid way and patrol that definition at the perimeter. I think one of the interesting things we can do here today and in the discussion that we have after this presentation is to query kind of where does design fiction, what does it let us do when we really relax the constraints on what design plus fiction can do together. So the two examples are, and I imagine they're probably familiar to many in this room, but I'll recap them briefly. The Clock of the Long Now is one, and The Spime is the other. So the Clock of the Long Now is an iconic project, I suppose, of the Long Now Foundation, which is sort of a cultural brains trust in Northern California. And the Long Now term comes from musician and Long Now board member Brian Eno, who, when he first moved from England to New York City, noticed that here meant within these four walls and now meant right this minute, whereas those were sort of more relaxed terms back in Europe. And so the Long Now was a kind of corrective concept to this foreshortened awareness temporally and spatially. And the Clock of the Long Now was a proposal of computer scientist and Long Now chairman Danny Hillis, who, when he was growing up in the 60s, noticed that the future seemed to be getting shorter by 1 year per year, because there were, everyone was fixated in, to the extent that they were thinking about the future, it was all based around the year 2000. And oddly, you know, this affliction continues. We still sort of seem to think that the future was the year 2000, and a lot of the you know, the ability to think in a high quality way about the future has sort of evaporated, it seems, in the meantime. So the Clock project is a way of embodying this corrective, this idea of the Long Now, and the intent is to build a 10,000-year architectural scale clock that you can actually go inside, inside a mountain in the desert in eastern Nevada, the organization already owns the mountain. The idea came up about 10 to 15 years ago, but the mountain has sort of already been picked out. And so this monumental project is an effort to, well, I'll come to the reason for it in a minute. So that's the first example. The second example is the Spime, or Spimes. And this, of course, is a coinage of Bruce Sterling sitting down there, who'll be joining us on stage in a moment. It's a contraction of space and time. It's an object that basically kind of contains its own autobiography, that has a digital footprint, so that we can know a lot more about it than we've ever known about the dumb stuff that surrounds us up till now. So the characteristics are: spimes are virtually designed, rapidly fabricated, taggable, searchable, geolocatable, and above all, sustainable. Now, these two concepts, at the risk of really blowing out the kind of abstraction-o-meter on this panel, these two concepts are both, I would argue, kind of edge cases for design fiction, because they are both sort of big picture visionary design ideas, and they're fictions at the time that they are suggested. But they're not intended to be fictions in the long term. They're intended actually to wend their way into the culture, into our conversations, and finally into materiality and into how we behave. And so, in particular, the spime ideas is a fascinating one to me, because it's the design there is actually in the creation of the word to begin with. And as Bruce said when he introduced it to this audience at South by Southwest in 2006, it's a designer word. It's a theory object which he created to put out there on the conversational landscape to serve as a strange attractor for a discourse about what the future of materiality can and should be. So the intention of Spime as a design fiction intervention is to sort of serve as a stake in the ground around which other efforts can begin to congeal. And similarly, the Clock of the Long Now, the point is not to have a 10,000-year timepiece. Yeah, I mean, as
1 minute
meaty a challenge as that is, from an engineering standpoint, the idea is really to change our attitudes and our relationships to temporality, and whereas the idea of the spime is to change our attitudes and our relationships to materiality. These are big picture ideas, and these are design fictions that are intended to do that. So I think, in particular, to sort of finish on that point, I think it's sort of interesting to consider that the clock might be regarded as a physicalized theory object, and that a spime might be regarded as a linguistic design fiction. So there, in other words, there are we can see design fictions as applying to how we intervene in the discourse, how we intervene in discussion, and we can see physicalized instantiations of that in the design fictions that Julian, Jake, and Sasha offered in their presentations. Thanks.
You guys did very well on time, speaking of time. Bruce, do you want to come up and join us? Everybody, welcome Bruce Sterling to our panel. I think I'll jump off the point of temporality in the long now from Stuart's last point. And I'm quite intrigued to get everyone's point of view on the importance of getting the time right in design fiction. With Julian, you've coined this phrase, the near future. And in the case of Sasha's work, it could be the recent past. Jake, you had this great quote when you were speaking. I don't know if you remember even saying it, but you said the future catches up to you even if you try to be ridiculous. So this idea of getting the time right with design fiction specifically, could you each comment on that?
I'll just start briefly. I think the idea is not so much, well, I mean, I'm pretty sure everyone will agree, but I'll just say it, that the time element isn't so much as cardinal years as it is the sense of possibility, that it's an extrapolation from now into something that seems like, that seems like that could be. So, for me, in looking at science fiction film, and even literature doesn't matter really, the sense that like, that sounds like something that is happening today, and it feels like it's much more imminently possible.
Yeah, I would agree and say that it's also about actionable time. So putting it in a space that's both far enough out where people can imagine and actually do something. You're not focused on the next year, but not so far out where people can put it off. You know, there is I think a temporal sweet spot now. How you represent that, changes because the future is moving fast and faster. I think another point is not just time, but plurality. I mean, that's something that we really talk about. There's not a single future. That's why we use the alternative futures method. There are a range of futures. You don't try to predict one future. You try to forecast a range of futures, and then you try to invent the preferred future within that range of possibility. And I think that's another important part of it.
I think in my case, it's two things. One thing is that I was quite interested in the scenario method as such, this kind of like Rand Corporation, Herman Kahn invented things. So I wanted to comment on that as such, because that's like the way that usually we talk about the future in the first place. But I think the more important thing when it comes to my project is that it's actually talking about us, but in disguise. You know, it's kind of like it's talking about the choices that they made with like geoengineering and kind of like infrastructural changes that kind of reflect on something that we might well need to do in the future. So it's kind of like their present might be our future and might be kind of like a interesting kind of like pocket to talk about these things without upsetting people, and kind of like it's just a mechanism to have a different perspective on ourselves, I guess. That's kind of...
Yeah, I don't have a lot to add to that, except that I think, the time... A timeline associated with any given scenario is just part of the heuristic ensemble that you're hoping is going to crack people's heads open in just the right way to the possibility that you want them to entertain.
I agree with Stuart that we were somehow nailed to the cardinal year 2000, and that and that so much freight loaded onto the year 2000 made futurism old-fashioned. And I agree that people's preconceptions have to be cracked there. I mean, we really need to understand the future is a process and not a destination.
Mm. Great. Well, now I'm going to channel one of the questions from the audience we get via Twitter. The question is, are there tools that you would recommend to outline and get design fiction done quickly? Or do you just use whatever you can?
Generally, use whatever you can. I've never been properly budgeted on a project. You piece it together. But it's also about you use what you can for the context. Using what you can with 600 people in a room is different. An enclosed space is different from putting up a plaque to the dead of a swine flu in 2016 in downtown Chinatown. So it's always undersourced, but it's also very contingent on the kind of effect you want to have on the audience and the context of which the designs occur.
Thank you.
There you go.
I'm curious about the quickly as part of that, because it seems to me that one of the great things that design fiction offers is to sort of relax the temporal constraint a little bit. I mean, obviously, if you can explore possibility space faster and more efficiently, especially in a corporate environment, time pressured, all the better. But doing it well seems to be more important to my mind.
I don't have my notes here to answer that question, unfortunately, but when I was in London recently at an event called Icon Minds, where Dunn and Raby, the sort of ICA geniuses of critical design, were there, we were making lists of conceptual tools that science fiction and design and futurism have in common, and there actually are quite a lot of them. It's very, very typical in design to see a story building and a meaning investment process where you go out and get notes from the environment, invent a fictional protagonist, try to solve problems. You're looking for dramatic inflection points or doing storyboarding. There's cartoons. In futurism, there's scenario work of all kinds. There's little theater style things, quadrants, so forth and so on. There's not quite enough of these tools for them to support a genuine speculative culture, in the sense that it could become a discipline, but I think it's too big for a discipline. I think it's happening, and there are many tools there, and I think that there's a lot of possibility for migration of these tools between disciplines and discourses, and they work. I mean, they are fast and cheap, and you do get unusual and spectacular effects when you use them. And they will make people talk about you.
So in the studio that I work in, I work at a studio at Nokia Design. These are not the opinions of Nokia's, caveat. But there are a variety of really wonderful, kind of fascinating, sort of very fast sort of story writing techniques we use that have been extrapolated or extracted from some of these genre conventions of science fiction film that I find absolutely fascinating. So doing things like creating advertisements from the future, creating a little mockumentary, breaking news segments from the future, describing some, and they essentially say what you could say if you wrote a scenario. If you said in the future there will be less pain in the world, but then if you're forced to actually put it into the context of something that someone's sort of visual apparatus or their reading skills of popular media might confuse with something that's real, then you get a more powerful kind of investment in that idea and that concept. So you see that thing and it looks like the crappy local news, but the story is just a little bit off, and so then you start having conversation about it, and it makes it, again, this thing, it makes it a little bit more legible. You can imagine that world in which that advertisement for that weird product actually exists.
That reminded me, I'd build on it a little bit. Use other people's work. I mean, if use films, they've created a universe for you, and just, riff on that, make an ad for something from Blade Runner, it pastiche scenarios or, fan fiction or whatever. Mm-hmm. Use what's out there and then just leverage it. That's another way to sort of shoehorn good ideas.
Jake, are you going to give the obvious example?
Well, 2 years ago, we told the story of post-Boogie Nights Dirk Diggler as a free culture warrior, and so we were able to use that universe that was created in Boogie Nights and project it out, and so that did a lot of the legwork. We didn't have to spend hours introducing you to a world. If you've seen the movie, you know it, and so you can just go from there.
And if you make a film, you can just go like Jean-Luc Godard and then Alpha View and just underexpose it a little bit, and it's going to look super futuristic.
So we have a question coming in also around this buzzword of late, especially in design circles, and I work at IDEO, so it's always on everyone's top of mind, behavior change. And so the question is, and I'm going to link this to another question that came in earlier, someone said, you know, is this not just role-playing when you were speaking, Jake? And I think you used the distinction of real play. So maybe you can blow that out a little bit. But how do you change behavior? Is that even a motivation when you're doing design fiction experiments?
The real play versus role play. I think, did that come out of World Without Oil?
I think so.
So World Without Oil was an alternate reality game positing a world where oil prices go through the roof and we basically can't, we don't have cheap gas to get around. So what do you do? And so people lived as if that world exists. And so they figured out social networking, carpooling hacks. They learned to make biofuels. So they did things that sort of, that's where the word transreality. So it sort of went from the virtual world into the real world, where all these tools that they created within the auspices of an alternate reality game, they actually were able to use when, I think, a few months later, the gas prices did spike. This was 08. And people actually were able to use some of the skills that they learned in the game itself. So that's sort of that where games in the transreality space can actually lead to behavioral change.
Yeah. And when you're in a game, you're kind of, I mean, it's your life anyway. You know, it's kind of like, even like computer games, like we all know that like when you're in the zone, it's kind of like you're there.
And perhaps some of these experiences, I think, when we were talking last night, and one of the, I don't know who said it, but we had some Dos Equis, so I can't remember. But a biocognitive visceral experience could be enough of a seed that's planted in you by way of just seeing or playing with or engaging with some design fiction that potentially behavior change could be the result. Maybe not, I mean, maybe that's not even a goal, but it could.
Sounds vaguely Sterling, yes, but yeah. I think what it makes me think of is there's this wonderful film, which is another one that helps me think about this stuff. It's actually a documentary called How William Shatner Changed the World, I think is the full title. And basically it's sort of like campy, as you would expect, William Shatner kind of going around and talking to people whose lives were directly impacted by Star Trek. So that's, it's, you know, he talks to the guy who became a medical doctor because he was fascinated with Dr. McCoy's medical bay. You talk to the guy who became like a, you know, plasma physicist because he was turned on by the technology of Star Trek when he was a kid. So it's that kind of like formative imaginary space that kind of explodes people's heads or splits them open or whatever it's happening and sort of turns them into a new interesting direction.
Right. And the biocognitive part of that is more and more neuroscience research is showing that we can't imagine we can only imagine the future from our experience of the past and the present. So there is sort of a cognitive bias or a cognitive limit to being able to imagine possible futures unless you have some sort of track that's laid in the past. So what this is trying to do is give you that sort of cognitive track. It's a sort of metacognitive technique to allow you to think about more possibilities than you would otherwise.
I think this segue from role-playing to real-playing may have some legs in the future because my suspicion is that if we had a more proactive attitude toward futuristic scenarios, you would find people doing public interventions as opposed to things like street demonstrations with puppets or clothing. Why not just get 500 or 600 people to dress up from the year 2017 and just spontaneously accumulate somewhere, you know, in the clothing, you know, just say take over a coffee shop or a city square, dressed as the change you want to see. So at that point, you would have street role-playing and really, you know, a potentially powerful subcultural intervention, just kind of a, you know, a live play Burning Man in the middle of a major city without any warning to the authorities, which was completely set designed, I think really could, you know, it could really kind of upset some apple carts there. And, you know, it could be a new form of popular action, really.
I think that sort of thing is beginning to happen already. I'm just in the process of wrapping up my dissertation in political science on experiential futures. So, you know, different term, but very similar ideas to what we're talking about here as design fiction. And one of my favorite examples in line with what Bruce just described, was the intervention in September 2008 of the Yes Men and Steve Lambert in New York City giving out New York Times special editions, which were perfectly mocked up, 16-page editions of the New York Times, future dated to July 4, 2009. And the headline on the front page was Iraq War Ends, with a whole, you know, with a picture and text and everything. But the entire newspaper was basically a wish fulfillment of a liberal agenda. Patriot Act was to be repealed, higher education was going to become free, gasoline-powered vehicles were being recalled. It was full of advertisements from both government and corporations. And, you know, by tangibly manifesting this possibility, you know, their particular idea of what they wanted America to be, it did, I think, open a lot of eyes, and it certainly got a lot of media attention, although the two subsequent versions of it that they did got virtually no media attention, which kind of flags up the importance of novelty in, you know, you can't sort of make lightning strike twice in the same place with something like this. But I think, just to loop it back to where the question began about behavior change, I'm very aware of that as a problem, and it's kind of a... it's kind of a question that underpins this whole dissertation on, you know, why do experiential futures, why manifest things, and especially in the street, as Jake and I have done. And I think it's maybe asking a little too much to sort of demonstrate immediate behavioral change as a result. I mean, because these are interventions at the level of perception, you know, and if you can buy that the futures you perceive, believe to be possible, and perhaps value, you know, what you consider to be possible, probable, and preferable, as futurists often call them, If you can buy that might in some way feed into the behaviors that you exhibit, then, you know, then the argument is made. If you don't, then, you know, it's kind of harder to prove. But
basically seeding something in people's minds.
Right. I mean, it's looking in the wrong place. If you want behavioral change, you know, make a law about it.
No, I see a lot of conceptual gadget work being done lately, which is, you know, interventionist and that sort. It's like, well, if this particular device existed, my social problem would be solved, and then you just sort of leave it there as a, you know, as a material intervention, and the assumption somebody might actually come along and build it.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to pick up on this idea of level of resolution, because the Yes Men, like you said, they rendered this newspaper as though it were, you know, almost you couldn't tell whether it were today's paper or the future paper of today. and sketchiness. So believability comes into play. How important is it that these are done to the level of resolution that they are believable? And how does that impact maybe that cognitive, visceral experience of the design fiction?
I enjoy actually making things and making them work. I find some value in actually going through the process of getting it as far as you can to looking like it works, if not actually working. Because a lot of things that happen in and around the various studios that I work in is about, okay, well, you know, we got to make something fall off an assembly line at some point, because that's how we keep our business going. So, you know, taking it to that level of fidelity. But the reason is not so much to finish the work, as much as it is to force you to learn the things that you couldn't have thought of if you just stopped at an Illustrator diagram or a sketch or even like something cut out of foam. So you go to this level of fidelity where you actually start building things and trying to make determinations about what kind of electronics part you need or how things are going to hook together or how they're going to communicate. And in that process, aside from the headaches that you get, you also learn something. That's actually a design process, as opposed to just, okay, we figured everything out, let's just solder everything together. It's in that process of doing the of doing the prototyping, you're actually learning about that kind of world that you're trying to manifest through that material object.
Another thing is that if you see something even if it's in a gallery that's really well made and kind of like suspends your disbelief about this existing in the real world, what happens is basically that you kind of like imagine this thing to be in your life, and you kind of like get this link between you and something that like whoever made that is kind of talking about. And many people who are like quoting Tony Dunn again, many people are actually interested rather in mass communication than mass production, but still like what's there needs to be kind of believable enough to be something, you know, kind of tangible enough for like the individual in a way.
Right, like the Auger Loiseau famous tooth that actually got coverage in the media as though it were a real design.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't actually expect that to happen. They were really surprised. This is some, it's like a guy called James Auger and Jimmy Lozo, and they made this tooth that was meant to be like a mobile phone. It's quite long ago, actually. It's like mid-90s. And they didn't actually intend it to happen that way, but the thing got picked up by like British mass media. And they just went along with it. And the impact of the thing was really, really amazing. I'm sure the point it actually got stolen in Berlin a couple of years ago, probably because somebody believed that it's like actually a real device. But they kind of like really for themselves took on the strategy of, which I don't do so much myself, but this kind of really pretending it's real to kind of like get people to think about it as if they could live with it in the near future, which is quite interesting.
Yeah. Right. Well, I write fiction, so I'm super interested in ideas of believability. And you know, that there's a folk notion that either you like buy it or you don't. You know, either you sort of believed it or like something snapped and you said, "Aw, the heck." But actually, believability is an extremely ductile process, and everything depends on social framing and how you're willing to put it across. Now, you know, a lot of people who would be interested in design fiction might lose interest in it because it's not about actual objects, and they think, okay, well, it needs to be more useful or more like industrial design, more practical. But, you know, I would point out that most objects and services are imaginary or just not real. I mean, the vast majority of them. And they're on a scale of believability. I mean, you've got classic sci-fi objects and services like robots, ray guns, spaceships, time machines. Occasionally you have a news pad style 2001 thing, which actually is a diegetic prototype, but most of them are frankly fantastic. I mean, there are no Stepford Wives, there are no time machines, there's not going to be any. And they are literary devices. Then you've got futuristic stuff, which, you know, is based on scientific principles that haven't been discovered yet. Okay, this is more the realm of futurism, industrial forecasting, fairly plausible. You've got critical design, like the Dunn and Raby interventions and these Yes Men things, which are imaginary objects that are meant to point out flaws in our society or that have some kind of political message. They're not real. They're there as critical interventions. They don't have to be believed in order to be effective. You've got dead stuff. Tons and tons and tons of dead stuff. Almost everything you people are working on, if you go to South By, obsolete in 10 years. Probably obsolete in 3. Couldn't be any deader if it were, you know, the pyramids of Giza. Just non-functional things in a context that don't exist. They will only be memories. There's vaporware, which is, you know, imaginary stuff meant to spread fear, uncertainty, and doubt. It's unleashed as a corporate maneuver. You're supposed to believe that it's going to be there, and you're supposed to not put money, or you're supposed to put money somewhere else. That is complete design fiction. Right. It doesn't exist. It maneuvers the industry. There is patented and unproduced stuff, 90% of patents, never made. In the vaults, nobody ever makes them. Never. Ever. Hobbyist stuff, homemade stuff, nobody's heard about it. Some guy dreamed it up, built in his basement, didn't even bother to patent it. Legions of this stuff. There's device art, conceptual art, things people do with in the art world. There's comical contraptions. As was being pointed out earlier, even when you're trying to be satirical, the future quite commonly catches up with you. I would refer you to Albert Robita, probably greatest technical forecaster of the 19th century, satirical cartoonist. A Rube Goldberg figure, a Heath Robinson figure. Very, you know, useful and interesting, but, you know, frankly impossible. I mean, just not plausible. Nobody believes in a Rube Goldberg machine. Nobody believed in a Heath Robinson's gadget pileup. Nobody believed Albert Robita, but he was one of the most consistently accurate forecasters. And then there's the fantastic and the occult and the sacred and just the physically impossible. Just complete fantasies. And those are always with us, and they're always going to be with us, and they're part of the human condition, and they should not be dismissed. So it's not a simple matter of, oh, well, there's design and there's design fiction. It's a slider bar. And there's a lot of maneuver room in there, much more maneuver room than we ever thought was possible.
At the risk of trying to say something after Bruce Sterling says something, in addition to the spectrum of believability, I think there's also maybe alongside it and intersecting at some points, is the spectrum of experientiality, let's say. And at one extreme, one end of that, is the purely hypothetical kind of cognitive thought experiment, which is what a traditional scenario would be. And then in the middle, you've got something like role play and games where you take on a role, and simulations, which are more sort of experiential because you are required to interact with them, or because there are media elements of them which are more visual and which speak to other sort of elements of the sensorium. And then at the far end, I think there's the sort of the as if of scenarios and gaming becomes the is of the hoax. Where you've got scenarios at one end, simulations in the middle, and then a kind of hoax right at the other end, and that's what the yes men are playing with, and sort of referencing back to probably, you know, the proto media hoax, the War of the Worlds performance by H.G. Wells in 1938, where people thought
Orson Welles,
yeah, sorry, written by H.G. Wells, dramatized by Orson Welles, thanks, and that was you know, that's an intervention at the level of ontology. That's an intervention at the level of what people think is really going on in the world, and kind of making a future, which, you know, I don't know what I would have thought in 1938. It seems kind of absurd to me to think that aliens were invading. But then again, you know, World War II was a year. Yeah, World War II was a year away at that point. You know, the trouble was brewing in Europe, and the idea of invasion and the, you know, the concerns of the time were tapped by that scenario in such a way that people sort of. They thought they saw the Martians, some of them, you know. So this spectrum of experientiality kind of moves us into some dangerous territory, I think. But that's sort of what design fiction is groping towards, it seems to me.
I'm just going to...
Final comments.
Yeah.
Do one more question because we only have a couple minutes.
All right. So this is quick. Yeah, I could talk to you about the art of the double take, don't break the universe, reward multiple levels of engagement. But my favorite story of believability was our Hawaii Hang Ten Flu, we called it. And we had a plaque, a memorial plaque to the dead who died in the Weeping Spring of 2016. And we would sort of mill about and try to kind of overhear people. And the favorite comment that we overheard was a guy looked at it, read it, examined it for a while, and he's like, they got the date wrong. Like, I don't know what he was thinking of. But, I mean, you know, just putting a plaque in a very official way on a building made him think it was. And, you know, so if you get the details right, people will believe it, whether it's ridiculous or not.
Okay, there's a great question from the audience, and that is, if the design fiction panel decided to collaborate together, what would you work on? What would the deliverable be? Anyone want to take a guess?
Well, you know, it would have to be one of those Henry Jenkins-style convergence culture things. It's sort of like Pokemon, where it's like a card game and a TV and a T-shirt and bumper stickers and, you know, a political intervention and a way to dress and a vocabulary and a pop music thing. But, you know, they're like small futurities, really, you know, and it could be doable. You know, I don't think it's that far-fetched. I mean, you just sort of start small and radiate outward.
Well, I told everyone what I want. It's a hive mind to be ridden in as a candidate for governor of Hawaii, of California this fall. So that'd be my goal.
Julian, Sasha, Stuart. Dream, design, fiction, collaboration.
I don't know.
I feel like we are collaborating.
Yeah. Right now we are.
Yeah, we totally are.
But is it real? Is it believable?
I can't believe there are this many people in the room when Quentin Tarantino is talking next door. So I'm sort of having a moment. I'm having a cognitive dissonance moment right now.
Yeah, it's a fiction come true that the room is not empty anyway.
Yeah, you're holograms. We ended on time. Any final questions you want to throw out? If it's not through a DeFi tweet, but through a real hand raising.
There we go.
Wow. Just ask.
It doesn't work.
Hello?
Okay. First of all, I just want to do a shout out. Unintentionally, I'm doing an unofficial panel, unofficial shindig about the novel in 2050, and it's sort of tangentially related to this. I put the information on the Twitter feed for this panel, and come see me if you want more details. We don't have, like any good futurist, I have no idea where the location will be tomorrow. Question, have you, climate change, do you think any of the futurist thinking has really been politically persuasive?
What do you mean, like concretely?
Well, do you think it's making a difference as far as how many senators are going to vote for climate change legislation?
You mean our projects or other things?
Well, I'm just talking in general. I mean,
you know, I would have to say it's one of the oldest futurist traditions. I mean, ever since I've been involved in futurism at all, which is, you know, gosh, maybe 40 years as a fan and 30 years as somebody messing with it, every futurist I've ever hung out with has known that climate change is a physical reality. It's one of the easiest things to predict. You know, there is nothing at all peculiar about it. And, you know, I've heard them hammer about this. I mean, I've been writing about climate change and science fiction from the very beginning of my career. It's a huge issue, and it upsets a lot of installed bases, but it's not like it's been difficult to see and that we've never been warned. I mean, everybody knows about it. It's saturated. But, you know, disbelieving in it is like imagining that AIDS is brought by the tooth fairy. You know, it's just a massive difficulty. So, do futurists ever... it's the Cassandra syndrome, really. I mean, you never know whether you're doing people any good by telling them stuff that you know is true and that is really going to happen. That people are I am writing a book about it, actually. But, you know, futurism as a line of work is pretty weird. And, you know, and so is design and so is fiction. And, you know, you put them all in the room and, oh, gosh. It's like network culture. It's a thing with 1,000 legs.
And scene.